The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Long. Representative Long. Representative Lucero.
Happy Friday.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston, excused. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Long. That concludes roll call.
And to the clerk, I count 16. Is that what you have?
Yes.
Very well. Then a quorum is present and will proceed. Members, I think, let me just connect with the clerk here real quickly. I think the minutes from yesterday have been prepared and distributed. Is that correct? This is to Ms. Ogunfalami.
Yes, that is correct.
Very well. And so I would entertain a motion to adopt the minutes of January 14th, if someone would be so kind as to move.
Chair, I will move to adopt the motions from January.
Thank you. Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes of January 14th for this committee. Discussion? Very well. We'll do this by voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes of January 14th of this committee are adopted. Members, first of all, I want to thank everyone for being here. Today we were supposed to have a storm across a good chunk of Minnesota. I don't know whether Minnesotans are getting soft or maybe there still is a storm coming, but this doesn't feel like anything that Minnesotans can't handle. Nonetheless, I do appreciate that some of you may have driven on slick roads to get to a place where you can join here virtually. And by the way, I've got to do this disclaimer. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic, requiring public health exercise of social distancing. The public can view House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota website. The public can also please come to the committee webpage at our Minnesota House website for instructions on how to participate in public testimony, as well as instructions on how to view these proceedings streaming online. Members, what I wanted to say quickly is that yet again this morning I awoke to a constant reminder of the importance of and the centrality of public safety to our individual well-being, but also to the well-being of our society and our system of government. And so my sort of Friday quick message of affirming your affirmation of the importance of the work that we are to undertake, that we are undertaking in this committee. It's going to require some hard work. It's going to require us consistently participating and being present, doing our work efficiently. Debating certainly tough and honestly, but simultaneously moving our work forward. Today's proceedings are, again, simple as they were yesterday in terms of what we'll be doing. We won't be taking any motions, but in keeping with the custom of our body, we're generally the first few weeks of committee hearings are taken up by reviews, overviews of the departments and governmental instruments that, in this case, deliver public safety and corrections, to receive overviews of those, as well as overviews of broad issues that are currently pressing for us. So with that, members, we're going to have two presentations today. We're going to have an overview of the Department of Corrections, and followed by a discussion. Then we will have an overview of Minnesota's probation delivery system, our three-tier system, also followed with discussion. And the way I've scheduled this for us today, members, is to have 20 minutes of presentation, followed by 20 minutes of discussion, and then repeat that with the second presentation. If we go over with the need to have questions on the first one, we'll just kick that over to the end of the agenda, pretty much as we did yesterday with Representative O'Neill's question that we came back to at the end of the day, or the end of the hearing, relative to the first part. So members, with that, I'm going to ask the commissioner of the Department of Corrections to come forward. I believe there's a PowerPoint presentation. What I would ask is, once the PowerPoint is done, if we can blink that off so that members can then view one another and testifiers, because, you know, presentations dominate the screen, I would greatly appreciate it. But with that, members, I welcome Commissioner Paul Schnell to our committee. Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's good to see many of you, at least virtually, and to see and meet virtually some of the new members to the committee. We're going to walk through an overview of the agency pretty quickly. I think, you know, it will give some background for many of the committee members. It may be things that you've seen before or are acutely aware of. But there's some new things that we think are really going to be valuable and important for members to be aware of, some things that we're working on that we're excited to share with you. Hopefully you can see the screen, and we'll walk through this. And by the way, my name is Paul Schnell, and I have the honor of serving now as the commissioner, and so I'm grateful to be here. One of the things we talked a little bit about last year at the beginning of the session, after the first, we did a ton of work when we started in January of 19, connecting with stakeholders across the state, the people we served, and certainly staff from the DOC and our partner agencies, who will be presenting here in a bit, to talk about our mission. And this mission is really important and something that I hope to convey, and you will see that we really are trying to set the agency up and the work that we do of serving this mission of transforming the lives for a safer Minnesota. We do believe that the Department of Corrections serves as part of the broad public safety network in our state. And ultimately, as we've talked about before, you know, 95% of the people that are in our correctional facilities across the state will come out into our communities. And this transformational work is so critical to ultimately to the safety of our neighborhoods and communities across our state. From a vision perspective, we believe that we have a responsibility to achieve justice through the promotion of racial equity, which obviously has dominated and rightly so much of the conversations that we're seeing since the murder of George Floyd and frankly before that. The restoration from harm that is caused by crime. And ultimately, what we know is that when communities are more connected, when there is more cohesion, ultimately there is less crime. And I think that becomes an important part of what we try to do as we look at reentry, reintegration, and creating a sense of connectedness, which ultimately serves the good of Minnesota overall. When we look at our agency by the numbers, we have approximately 4,300 employees, the third largest agency in the state. A general fund budget of $1.2 billion biennially. We have 10 correctional facilities in the state. Our full capacity is 9,522 beds. So that's in a double bunked state. Our current population is approximately 7,300 adults. We operate 7.5 million square feet of space throughout our facilities. And I would just point out one of the things that frequently will come up as we talk about facilities, and I know next week we'll be talking a little bit more about COVID and the OLA report. You know, this has been one of the areas of significant concern. We have about $600 million in deferred maintenance that the agency faces. And so that has been an ongoing issue. We provide community supervision to approximately 20,000 people across the state, men and women, both in probation as well as supervised release and intensive supervised release. And we operate 17 district field supervision offices. And you will hear from our partners in the county probation offices, as well as the Community Corrections Act counties who round out the supervision, and you'll see some of the larger numbers there. As an agency, we have a number of obligations that have been statutorily defined. We know that we have to provide health care to those who are incarcerated. It is one of the fundamental obligations constitutionally. We also really have this obligation to address the health and well-being, providing treatment programs for substance use disorder, sexual offender treatment, and other rehabilitative programs that would fall into this broad area of healthcare. We have an obligation to provide transition planning and reentry services for those who are coming from our facilities back out into the community. We have an opportunity to provide a level of education to those who are incarcerated. We have the role of inspection and licensing of county jails and juvenile detention facilities across our state and juvenile detention facilities in other states. We, in our partnerships with Community Corrections Act, we review and work with them on comprehensive plans, which are submitted and facilitate pass-through funding. And we provide correctional supervision, as I mentioned, to a variety of counties across the state. This just gives you some perspective of our 10 facilities, and you can see the capacity that each of these facilities have and where they're located throughout the state. You know, one up near the Canadian border, and the furthest south is in Faribault. Most on the eastern edge of the state, with St. Cloud being really more centrally located. These facilities range in age from more than 120 years old, with I think the newest being Rush City, which ultimately was built in around 2000. So we're looking at around 20 years old. We have varying different levels of custody, and I point this out just because people say, well, is there a difference between these facilities? And yes, we have different levels of security, and I'll start with five first. We have one level five, which is our maximum custody, level custody or security facility at Oak Park Heights. Then there are close custody level would be level four, Rush City, St. Cloud, and Stillwater. Level three is medium custody, Lino Lakes, Moose Lake, and Faribault. And then we have minimum facilities as well. And some of these minimum facilities are on the campuses of other facilities, but they're outside the fence. And some of them are standalone. For instance, Willow River and Togo. And Red Wing, there's an adult component at of minimum custody folks at men at Red Wing. Shakopee is the one state women's facility, and that covers all security levels. population, and I know we'll have some conversations next week in our COVID response, but I think this is a really important chart for us to look at. You know, we can look back July of 2000, our state population was about 6,200, just shy of 6,300 men and women were in state correctional facilities. And you can see that over the course of 5 years, we went from that to, you know, not quite doubling, but, you know, over 10,000. And since that time, we've seen these numbers come down. And you can see that line of our capacity, again, assuming double bunking, that where we've had to procure or lease or get jail beds in other counties. And we sometimes have to do that anyway in terms of moving people around as we may face different issues in our facilities, or depending upon a custody level, we don't have capacity in some of our medium or close or obviously Oak Park, the highest level, where we would use county jails to take some of that pressure off. And now we're at about 7,300 in our population, and some of that largely due to the courts being impacted by COVID. Minnesota has the fourth lowest incarceration rate in the nation, but we're the fifth highest in supervision in our country. About 7,200 people on community supervision, and there will be a presentation on this immediately following this. About 100,000 adults and youth are on probation or supervision status statewide, and there are three delivery systems, which the esteemed panel will talk about afterwards. I think this really leads to, so that gives you just a sense of the background. And I want to walk through kind of where we sit and what our strategic plan is, that all this work that was done and really comes out of and informed by both the information that we receive from staff, and partners, and impacted people throughout the system. But as well, we also relied on information that came from studies, research, as well as like the OLA safety report that I believe will be discussed in a hearing next week. And we when we look at our strategic plan, it breaks down into kind of three buckets or three kind of strategic areas. And I would just put the transformative programming as central to that, safety and well-being. You can't do transformative programming without having safety and the well-being of our staff, as well as the people we serve. And then how do we have an organization that ultimately supports that? And I'll walk through this and kind of highlight some of the key areas in each of these strategic priority areas. As it relates to transformative programming, we have really put in place a system where we want to engage both public as well as system stakeholders in the creation of our programs and policies. Ultimately, we know that, you know, the average person comes into a Minnesota prison for about 31 months. And so that's the typical, if you look at it from an average standpoint, person that comes in. And what we want to make sure that during that time, that we really have and provide the best intervention services, transformative services that we can offer, because that is a benefit to our communities. And we believe and know that that has to be informed by a range of our stakeholders. We want to and need to use evidence-based practices, and we have a variety of goals for doing this. We want to make sure that we're looking at the engagement of community-based programs, increasing our technical and college training by 400% is one of our goals, and that really was aided by recent federal action on Pell funding that now becomes available to people who are incarcerated. And these things ultimately will help to provide that transformation and drive success when people go back into the communities. We also have some goals around looking at reductions of readmissions to the facilities, which, as we've talked about in the past, becomes a huge burden on the system. In the safety and well-being area, as you know, we have to and work on the management of COVID, and that will be with us for some time. I know we'll be talking about that in more detail next week. But ultimately, we want to make sure that we have safe environments, and those safe environments have to be for our staff who come in every day, and I'm really proud of who, despite this pandemic and despite some of the massive outbreaks that we've had in our facilities, have come in every day and done their job, incredibly well under those circumstances. We have to have the safety of the incarcerated population. You can't engage people in transformational work without having a safe environment. We have to recognize the fact that we have an obligation to the people who have been impacted by crime, the survivors, the victims, and that becomes important. And we also need to make sure that there is safety for our staff as well as the people out in supervision. Again, there's very little hope in environments where there is not safety. We are prioritizing a better workplace culture, which has been identified as the OLA as an important objective. Looking at onboarding culture and creating a culture of well-being in our and among our staff, and providing resources and training to our staff and working with partners, because ultimately, if we can reduce victimization, it's a lofty goal and perhaps impossible, but we have to have set a vision toward zero revictimization of the people we serve, and that has to be our goal. And obviously, we need to provide healthcare that addresses the acute needs of people, but really is focused on their health. We want people, when they go back, to be in a position where they are in the most stable position they can be, whether it's from a medical or health standpoint, as well as a recovery standpoint. And then finally, I want to just highlight this agency reorganization. And one of the things that we saw, and I think some of this really came out of OLA, some of this, but certainly things that we saw as we over the last 2 years. And I would also say that as we face some financial challenges, you may know that MinCorp had some challenges with the impact of COVID. And as a result, their revenues are down. They fund some educational program and they fund some other reentry services. And we ultimately had to make some reductions in staffing here. And really what some of these things started to have us do was question, are there ways that we can reduce siloing, improve our communication across the agency, maximize cross-unit collaboration, improve oversight, and reduce costs? And we believe that some of the ways we're organizing can and will do that. We have implemented an agency research and performance measurement system and unit that ultimately will provide both public and internal transparency. We will look to build public-facing dashboards that people can access, very similar to what people have seen in our COVID response website, which is updated regularly and people can see exactly what's happening. We want to shift the way we use our resources. Right now, a person comes into prison, it's generally they're going to receive a lot of the core treatment services and those sorts of things immediately prior to their release. In talking with people and talking with experts across the nation and looking at the research, we believe it's important to front-end load that stuff. And we have teams that are working today to think about how we bring people in, how we develop person-centered, individualized program plans with a goal of transformation. We are looking at really doing these teams that are focused on achieving results that we can measure. And servant leadership becomes one of our goals. I'm not going to go into the depth of this, but we believe what's important. One of our shifts is taking a person-centered approach. We can't treat everybody who comes into the system the same. We have to recognize that there are different risk factors that they may have, different needs that they may have. They may themselves have been childhood victims of adverse experiences. Many of our people are. And so we have to be in a position where we understand and address those needs if we expect them to go back into the community and do well. We ultimately are looking at this shift toward a person-centered approach that really does comprehensive assessment, a wraparound multidisciplinary team of healthcare, behavioral health, and others to be able to address both risk and needs and help navigate the services that the DOC can provide. And ultimately, our partners in supervision front, either our agents or agents of the community corrections at counties, would then do that on the community level as people go back out. And then we change, again, our programming to address that. And so I wanted to share with you and just introduce some of the people who are leading these areas and just talk about what's in them. Just organizationally, we are set up really funded in three basic program buckets. One is operations. It covers just a lot of the more administrative functions. A large chunk goes into facilities. And then the third is the community services and the pass-through funding that goes to the county. This is what the new organization chart, and while it looks complicated, I just want to point out that research and planning and organizational performance, that is something that we want to cover the entirety of the agency, because we think it's important that, one, as the OLA said, that we're making decisions about what we do and how we do it based on good data. And ultimately, we have an obligation to you as elected leaders in this state, as well as the public, to make sure that we're achieving and delivering the kinds of results that are necessary. And then we broke out service, what we're calling service clusters, and that's organizational, regulatory, facility safety and security, health recovery and programming unit, this person-centered planning unit, which handles orientation assessment and program planning. And then they help navigate that person through their time in our facilities. And then that connects directly with this reintegration and restorative services unit, formerly known as community services, which is the community supervision and the range of services that go along with that, along with reentry and so forth. So this just gives you a sense of the perspective of how it is that we're envisioning services. We make sure that we break down the siloing of some of the business units that fall under these service clusters so that there is much higher levels of accountability as well as awareness of what's happening, and that those services become integrated for the benefit of the people we serve, and that we're delivering the best product that we can for Minnesota and doing that as wisely as we can. I was not going to have that picture in there, but somebody made me put that in. But that was me. I'll just break down the way this operates. Deputy Commissioner Michelle Smith oversees facility safety and security. That's all of the facility wardens, central transportation, nutrition, safety. And I want to point out MnCorp, because MnCorp is a little bit of a unique animal in terms of the Department of Corrections. It really functions as an enterprise. And that enterprise has to be self-sustained. It is not funded by state tax dollars. It operates a bunch of industry programs that people and vocational training programs and some reentry and transition programs for people that we serve. But ultimately, it has to generate revenue in order to do that, and covers the cost of its staff as well as provides pay. For low levels of pay for people who are working in that system, but ultimately it's very important for the people in our custody. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, who you'll meet in just a minute, oversees this reintegration and restorative services unit, and this really covers the range of things that happen on the community front, and we're seeking to really build stronger integration between what happens on the inside and what happens on the outside. But we also have to recognize that really, again, looking at the number of people that are in prison or out on supervised release, it's a very small number overall when we look at what happens with probation in our state. Assistant Commissioner Brian Collins, who oversees this person-centered, and this is all brand new and really being developed right now. We're working across the DOC to really develop and refine what this looks like. And our plan is to have this in full-scale operation later this fall. And all we're doing, this is not requiring new resources. What we're doing is shifting resources and using resources to accomplish these objectives and putting that at the front end versus the back. Nan Larson, who's now an assistant commissioner who oversees the health recovery and programming unit, she has been with the DOC for a long time, oversaw health, the healthcare services. And, but we really felt that you can't talk about health and well-being without talking about the whole person. And so putting programs together so that there is integration, so that we think about how we deliver them and get people what they need as they're with us. Whoops. Assistant Commissioner Marcus Smith, who really oversees this organizational and regulatory services. This is all of the kind of internal facing stuff in many cases, but it also includes some of the really important things like jail inspection and enforcement, our sentence and administration unit, HR, IT, and the Office of Professional Accountability, which was something that we put in place since we've been here and something that the OLA really talked about. In addition, victim services, and a variety of other functions that the agency has. And then this research, planning, and organizational performance unit, that long one that covered the whole agency. Daniel Karpowitz is the assistant commissioner, and he oversees that unit, and they are into every operation within this agency. And so there is a massive amount of work being done by this unit. And trying to decide, you know, what are the measures that become so important that from an accountability standpoint, as well as from an outcome standpoint. So they are working on that, and there's a lot going on. And again, they are really a part of how do we make sure that we're doing good assessment of people as they come into our system, so we know what the risks and needs are, and what kind of services that we can provide that they will be responsive to. And then just to give you just to round out the exec team of communications, we have government and external relations, and many of you have met Safia, and finance is a part of this team, and then legal. And one of the things I just want to point out about legal, while we have a general counsel, we have a few more attorneys than some agencies do, because our legal general counsel office does, you know, both legal advice within the agency, but it also does a lot of litigation work relative to habeas cases and works very closely with the AG's office in litigation cases. And this won't be a surprise to any of you that there is a good amount of litigation that happens related to our work. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions. I know it was very quick. We felt it was important just to give that sense of oversight, and I'd be happy to answer questions to go into more detail if that's when it's appropriate.
Thank you, Commissioner. We will do about 20 minutes of question and answer, and your timing was darn near perfect. And in that regard, I do just want to acknowledge, you know, the proud tradition, I believe, in our state of having a strong, well-run corrections system. I like to think that we're one of the systems that other states look to, but I also know that it's important for us to constantly scan and learn and adapt and adopt best practices. I do want to do a quick shout out. I was pleased and excited to hear about the congressional action relative to access to the Pell Grant, which will then allow for access to higher education opportunities, probably heavily, you know, in technical skill development, which is so critically important for reentry work and to be able to keep our state strong. And so I'm glad that we're back on a proper direction, in my opinion, and pleased to see that our congressional leaders thought that was important, and of course the executive branch signed off on that. Just a very quick question, I appreciate the strategic plan that you laid out, the three interconnecting pieces. I totally get, after last year's hearings and visits out to particularly Stillwater, you know, the connection between safety and transformative programming. And I also heard, many of us did, directly from both residents and staff about the critical importance of getting back to that place as we adjust our practices to keep our places and make them even safer. In order to do that, for a lot of reasons, including being able to get back to fulfilling that mission of providing that place of hope and development, which is part of our mission. This will be a longer question that we will no doubt dive into in the coming weeks. So don't feel like you got to cover it all, but I just want to kind of set the table a little bit here that as we meet our mission in corrections, this is multi-pronged. You know, first and foremost, public safety, keep the public safe. There's a safety element inside our facilities as well as outside our facilities and eventual reentry. There's also, and I know this, and I think many of our members know that incarceration costs, you know, depending on how you do it across the nation, can be phenomenal budget busters for states. I remember a decade or so ago with New York taking huge steps to rein in this burgeoning beast that was just consuming, making it hard to fund their schools, K-12 schools, and you know, health services, et cetera. California, you know, under Supreme Court, their Supreme Court direction for a number of reasons, including civil rights issues, but also, you know, as big as California is, having a hard time, you know, meeting that economic thing. So, and again, not a deep thing, but it does seem to me that you would have hope that the strategic planning department, particularly as you shape out this person-centered approach, will one, accomplish good things relative to our mission, but hopefully accomplish it in such a way where there are actual cost benefits, cost savings, and hopefully, quite frankly, in my opinion, cost redirection or expense redirection. And I just want to check quickly. You and I have had a little bit of a conversation about this, but if you could just say something, you know, quickly about that, and then, as I said, we'll come back to it in future hearings.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would just say, yes, we believe, and I think there's ample evidence, and frankly, this is not a partisan issue. We're seeing some of the largest kind of philanthropic organizations, conservative philanthropic organizations that really are wrapping around the fact that this is not a system that can be maintained, that there are mechanisms of being able to have safety and accountability without you know, massive growth in incarceration and the costs related to that. And really, so we're driven by in this and by the fact that we have to, I believe, we have a responsibility to create a safe communities, and part of that is accountability. But we do that ultimately by addressing people's risk and needs, by better supporting the victims, and ultimately managing all of these interests. And so we have some ideas that we think that we would like to talk with the committee about ways that we think we can actually achieve some cost savings, better outcomes, measurable outcomes, and in concert with a partnership with our supervision partners to really maximize the benefit and make our system more sustainable. And so I look forward to talking to you, but I do see this as an important objective that is has certainly been on both sides of the aisle, at least in the federal system. There has been a lot of collaborative work done around trying to do some criminal justice reforms and on both sides of the aisle.
Very well. We will continue this conversation. I think it's critically important. I do want to re-highlight a part of your response, which is that whatever system, I'm paraphrasing, you know, involves working to help move forward and meet the needs of our residents in our facilities and the victims of their past crimes and injustices. And I think it's just critically important that we not lose sight of the importance of meeting that whole community need, yes, and making sure we're always naming our victims as well. So thank you very much. With that, we have a couple of questions. I have Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation, Commissioner Schnell. I was particularly impressed with your content around the person-centered approach strategy, and I think that's the right direction. And it seems like in making a shift of that type in an organization as large and complex as the Department of Corrections, that there are inevitably challenges. And I'm interested to know what have been some of the challenges that you all have faced in making that pivot And are there ways that the legislature can help you all in achieving those goals?
Commissioner Stowe.
Chair Mariani, Representative Long, I think, you know, this is a massive shift. We're really turning the entire way that we have delivered services. In the past, what would happen, there were certainly assessment that happened when people came in, but that assessment really focused on medical education, substance use, a mental health screening, and that was pretty much it. And yet we know that people, all of us, are so much more than that. And I think ultimately it's, what are the support systems that they have? How do we engage with them early? How do we, from day one, how do we think with the end in mind? How do we make sure that when we have people coming into our facilities, or frankly, they get put on probation, that we're thinking about ultimately the end is a person who is more deeply integrated in their community and somebody who's contributing versus taking, and ultimately this becomes part of the objective, whether it's in the probation system or in the prison system. And I think this orientation toward a person-centered approach means that we better identify the gaps in services. In other words, as I'll just use one example, we have treatment programs. Are our treatment programs culturally competent? Are we providing culturally specific treatment programs where we could have better outcomes if we did that? And these are things that, being more person-centered, will force us to look at how we shift our delivery of those services, how we maximize our partnerships in the community as we think about people transitioning, and ultimately all of it toward producing measurably better outcomes, and doing that in the most efficient using the kind of the best stewardship of public resources we possibly can. And so we're really excited about it. It's tough because we have people that we're doing and providing services to people more at the back end today, and making that shift is something we have to be very thoughtful about how we do that. And oftentimes, as we've talked about before, churn in our system, those people who come in for very short periods of time, we spend a lot of time, energy, and effort on them, and oftentimes are not able to provide intervention services because of their short time. Now, we're looking at, as part of this, of developing more comprehensive community-based plans in concert with supervision people because community services, because ultimately the good planning will result in better outcomes. So the biggest challenge is making that shift, front-end loading, and then having, you know, we're even thinking about things. I think it's very interesting. You know, what's it like for a person coming into prison the first time? And we're asking them to share with us about adverse childhood experiences and those sorts of things. And in order to have people trust that system is going to be responsive to addressing those kinds of things, we have to create environments that say this is important. We want to make sure that there is acknowledgement of the people who've been hired by them, and that the people who come to the system run that and try to as they can, and part of maybe living the best possible. Ultimately, you know, the shift is actively happening, and there will be lessons along the way and missteps, but we're excited, and our staff have been really gracious and excited about working to help get us.
Thank you, Commissioner. You froze up here. We lost some of that, but I think we got the gist of it. Thank you for that. I'm going to move on. Thank you, Representative Long. I'm going to move on to Representative Edelson. And hopefully, by the time you pose your question, we'll have the commissioner back here. If not, we can always jump to another staffer, I said, or another person. Representative Edelson. Oh, you're back, Commissioner. Okay, I think your staff will probably text you about what's going on here. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. I want to thank the commissioner for for being here today and for what he's saying in terms of addressing short stay. My question actually has to do with that in terms of technical violations. Looking at not people that are coming back to prison because they committed a new crime, but because they violated the term of their release. I'm curious how much we're seeing that in the state of Minnesota. I want to know, if so, what are we doing about it? Because I think we know the collateral consequences of such going back to prison in this instance for a technical violation results in loss of unemployment, loss of housing, loss of transportation. So it costs our society and our state a great deal. So I'm wondering what that picture looks like. We talked about it a little bit in the last term, and would love to hear the commissioner address that again.
Thank you for the question. Let's see if the commissioner is able to.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to stop my video because that may help a little bit. Yep. Hopefully, we are
Commissioner, looks like the storm might be interrupting your transmission. I'm wondering if maybe one of your administrative staff. Who's available might be able to jump in.
Chair Mariani, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin here. I could take Representative Adelson's question if that would help.
Please, yes, Deputy Commissioner, welcome.
So thank you, Chair Representative Adelson. First and foremost, thank you for the question. I first want to just acknowledge that 60% of the admissions that we see that come back into our facility are for technical violations. The DOC is responsible for making decisions for those who we on supervised release. And for those cases, the DOC has already issued guidance to its own agents, as well as county corrections partners, that highlights the need for us to use immediate sanctions and restructures to the extent possible. And this as long as it goes without impeding public safety. There are still instances when public safety is at risk, and the department will continue to look at revocations in those instances. I think it's important to also point out there's been a number of other different strategies. While we have seen a decrease in the number of overall admissions to our facilities for violations, we still see technical violations still moving at the same rate at which we're seeing new offenses. And I think that's something that the department is committed to continue to work with our other delivery system on ways in which that we can effectively address that. Because as we know, when we are able to keep people out in the community, it provides them to stay on a better track without impacting, you know, their jobs, their housing, and providing further instability that we know occurs when we have people come into the facilities unnecessarily. Good question, Representative.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. We're almost out of time with this section. I do have a couple of questions left. I'm going to call on Representative Johnson, and then Representative O'Neill will circle back if there's still time, because I want to make sure we get to the probation presenters, but we will certainly be on that list. Minority Leader Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. Commissioner Sell, I want to thank you. Hopefully you're still on, and I hope you can stay on until after the next segment, because there's some issues in that one that we need to talk to you about as well. But I just want to thank you, because it's been known for years that providing the services at the front end has a much better success rate than at the back end. And I want to thank you for finally getting that done. Many other organizations have been doing that all along, and with good success. It's just unfortunate that the state has waited so long before they do that. So thank you for doing that. And like I say, I hope you can stay on during the probation delivery system, because we have some questions on that would be in your purview.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I couldn't agree more with your comment. That was so quick that Representative O'Neill, I'm going to go ahead and jump to you.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner, it's good to see you again today. We had a nice conversation yesterday. I just wanted a point of clarification, because I've been tracking the technical violations for some time, and it seems to me that before we actually did any intervention, which is on the front end, we had 60% admissions back then that were for technical violations. And I realize that we have an overall decrease in admissions into the prison system because of COVID, but can you tell me, are they doing the alcohol and drug treatment on the front end to kind of deal with the technical violations? You know, if that is being done. I know you're doing restructuring, but because of COVID, everything just seems kind of in a disarray. So if you could just help me understand that, because if not, then I'm going to write a bill and do the alternatives to incarceration bill again and try to get a little bit of money to do that. So can you just tell me where we're at specifically with treatment?
Very good, Bill, and a very good question, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative O'Neill, really good question. And I would just encourage you, anytime that we're looking at any form of alternative to any of our facilities, I think that's a good idea. So even absent of how I address this question, I would encourage you to continue to look at ways in which we can support alternatives to incarceration. As the commissioner has spoke to, we are still in the process of looking at better ways in which where we can front load services. I think the things that we ultimately want to avoid is having people come into our facilities and essentially sitting for what we consider dead time where we're warehousing. So how can we essentially align our programming on the front end so when someone comes in with the treatment directive, they're actually getting those treatment directives met so that they can continue to move on and move out of the facility and reintegrate back into the community. But again, so that is something that, as the commissioner alluded to, we are committed to looking how do we front load those services. Any support that you are willing to offer, it will be well appreciated as we continue to look to address this. Good question. Thank you.
Sounds like we might see some legislative action here. Thank you for the question, Representative O'Neill. You know, when we visited Stillwater, it was just, yeah, I don't know whether they planned it. I don't think so. But both the residents and the guards, as they walked us around and sat with us, you know, raised this issue and that whole thing about dead time and what an incredible, not only suck of energy, but quite frankly, also from both, you know, communities, what a challenge it was to have these individuals introduced into that culture, you know, when, you know, they're going to be gone, you know, relatively soon. So the motivation, you know, to be able to continue to work on shaping a good, you know, productive culture there was really challenging. So I want to thank
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick final comment. So something else I would encourage the DOC to continue to do that we had talked about, I know, offline, is that you would do the treatment in-house earlier instead of right at the very, very end as they're heading out the door, because then you know how long it takes to change habits and to change mindsets. And so I know that that work could be done. And with COVID again, we just have kind of not connected back again, but the more you can do earlier treatment so they can have some time to adjust to their new life, their new normal, so to speak, would be so helpful, I think. I know that that was the conversation. So I just want to leave you with that last thought.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. That echoes Representative Johnson's earlier comments as well. Commissioner, I want to thank you for your presentation today, as well as for your administrative team, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin and others who are present. And I also want to do a shout out to the excellent team of public servants that we have in this department. It's a big department, over 4,000 employees, guards for sure, our support staff, education staff, reentry staff, health providers, nurses. It's a very diverse, professionally diverse work group. Terrific public servants who have been operating under some, and continue to operate under some scary, tense times, you know, in the midst of this pandemic. We'll have that conversation next week. But I just want to do a shout out of the terrific team of public servants that we have, from administration all the way out to our guards and nurses in this department. With that, members, we're going to move on to the second part of the presentation, which is an overview of the three-tier probation delivery system. We have a number of new members to this committee, so we don't want to assume that folks understand how we're structured that way in terms of providing community supervision, probation services in our state. So we're going to do hopefully a good walkthrough of that. And I have three individuals who are lined up for that, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, County Probation Director from Cass County, Jim Schneider, and then Hennepin County Community Corrections Director, Catherine Johnson. We'll do 20 minutes of presentation and then 20 minutes of questions, and we will end on time at noon. So with that, Deputy Commissioner, I think you're probably leading this off. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair. Members of the committee, Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner here at the Department of Corrections, where I oversee our Reintegration and Restorative Services Unit. I want to first say thank you for this opportunity again to give an overview of community supervision here in the state that I'll be doing along with two of my additional colleagues. But also want to say I continue to hope that all of you and your families are continuing to do well and stay blessed and healthy as we still deal with what feels like uncertain times with the results of this global pandemic.
Amen.
As mentioned, Minnesota has three delivery systems who provide community supervision across the state. All three of those delivery systems will be represented here today and will have an opportunity to take part in this collaborative presentation. So with that, I'll see how good I am with sharing my screen here. Can you, we good to go, Chair? Is that popping
that
up correctly?
That looks good, Deputy Commissioner.
All right. So here in Minnesota, we do rely heavily on community supervision. As a former agent, I would like to think because we know that supervision and supportive services work when it is applied appropriately. Here in Minnesota, we have nearly 140,000 clients, both adult and juveniles, on probation statewide, with an additional nearly 7,000 adult clients on supervised release, which is administered by both our CCA counties and the DOC. As the commissioner talked about, here in Minnesota, we do have relatively low incarceration rates. This has been true, as this slide represents, since 2016, and it's true here in present day, as the commissioner went over. We have roughly around 7,300 incarcerated women and men in our state facilities. And while we do have one of the lowest incarceration rates in the nation, the reverse is also true when it comes to community supervision. Additionally, when you combine our incarceration and our supervision rates, unfortunately, Minnesota ranks probably within the top third in the nation for our citizens who are under some form of correctional control. This slide right here really illuminates how our three delivery systems are present across the state, with our CCR Community Corrections Act County, CCA counties represented in the green areas, providing supervision for nearly 74,000 clients across the state. Our CPO partners are represented in the orange, and they provide supervision for nearly 12,000 clients. And the DOC is shown in the blue areas, providing supervision to nearly 18,000 clients, while also providing ISR, Intensive Supervised Release, and CIP, our Challenge Incarcerated Program, in over 82 counties across the state. Noted here are the key factors based on statute, which really govern our delivery system. One of the things I wanted to important to highlight is our state biennial budget process, which plays a significant role in the way we allocate state funds that we utilize as our pass-through dollars. And as I kind of mentioned before, I think here in Minnesota, we believe that that probation works on behalf of our incarcerated women and men who have made the transition back into the community. But that also means that it has to be applied appropriately and adequately funded. And I think I would be remiss to just mention, and I think this has been historically true, even which predates me, some of the challenges, particularly when we think about adequate funding, how that might impede some of the great work that has gone on and some of the great work that I know my other two colleagues who are representing delivery systems are committed to doing. And so as we continue to look toward transformative change and equitable outcomes, and how do we provide not just supervision, but supportive services for our folks that have transitioned out into the community, I think we have to continue to be creative with ideas to provide adequate funding as such. And while we do have three separate delivery systems, I think it is vital to put a strong emphasis on how collaboratively we work together. And that is really driven by so many of the common approaches that we have, whether that is our client approach to supervision, which really is based in using evidence-based practices here in corrections, whether it's how we collaborate with training, whether that's provided training, whether it's cross-training with my other delivery system partners, which is really invited to all agents across the state. But more importantly, how do we collaborate together on changes involving big policies? And I think I just want to highlight to this, because this even predates myself as well, and something that we continue to build on, how all three delivery systems have come together around some big policy decisions. And I think that shows just the commitment that all three delivery systems have to putting in the work and having a seat at the table to collectively try to address some of the challenges that are facing all three of our delivery systems. You know, when we talk about evidence-based practice, one of the key elements are our use of risk assessments. This infographic shows how applying an objective risk assessment tool enables us to match up our level of supervision to actually match the risk level of the individuals at which we serve. And so if you look up to the left, you'll notice, you know, without a risk assessment, you know, how are you able to then identify who are those who might be at a higher risk to rearrest? After applying a risk assessment tool, you're able to drill down on that a lot further, which then enables you to really look at what is the appropriate measure of supervision when we're talking about supervision intensity, but how does that also align when we are also looking to address their needs in the appropriate fashion with a high degree of supportive services. And I think it is the belief, and I think this is shared amongst my partners too as well, that community supervision is based on science. So once we know the risk factors of an individual, then we can apply three principles of evidence-based practice, which really talks about risk, need, and responsivity. So when you think of this, you can think about this as the who, what, and how. So who do we need to in fact target with a high degree of both supervision and supportive services? The what, you know, what are their criminogenic risk factors and needs? As the commissioner mentioned here at the department, when we think about through a person-centered focused approach, thinking about that person as the individual they are, that's taken again into maybe their particular background, other dynamics that might be facing. So we can really view that that person as the individual that they are and really tailor our service to really try to address both that person's risk level as well as that individual's needs. And then a responsivity principle. So how do we respond accordingly to address both the risk and the needs principle? And that's using an approach, again, that is specific to that individual client when we're talking about person-centered. And that could be looking at both gender responsivity principle and providing and also race and ethnicity when we're looking at what is appropriate programming and supportive services that are needed specific to the individual so that we can ensure that we're responding accordingly to get the equitable outcomes that we are striving to get. And with that, that wraps up my portion of this presentation. And so I will pass the baton to one of my colleagues, Mr. Schneider, who will take over from here. I'll continue to man the PowerPoint on behalf of MACPO. So with that, Jim, if you're ready, I'll turn the presentation over to you.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schneider. Please state your name for the record and let's hear your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. My name is Jim Schneider. I'm the current director of the Cass County Probation Department. I'm also the current president of the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. Chairman Mariani, thank you again for allowing field services to come into our conversation. You've allowed us to present on a number of years, which really stimulates the conversation at a state level about what's going on in field services. So I just want to really shout out to you and the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just real quickly, the county probation system was established back in 1959. We partner with the Department of Corrections, as the deputy commissioner had alluded to, where they provide felony supervision, parole service, probation, and supervised release. And county probation departments complement that by handling all juvenile cases within our counties, and then misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. And we currently, as the Deputy Commissioner alluded to, we partner with them on 25 counties. Next slide, please. I just want to talk a little bit about our partnerships, because our partnerships are really valuable to what we do. Of course, we're county probation. We're connected with our counties, with our budgets. We're connected with tribal governments for those counties that are connected within tribal governments. Cass County in particular, within our county government, has a signed memorandum of understanding that all department heads are to work with the Leech Lake Nation when it comes to commonalities that are currently going on, whether it's roads and bridges, human services, or probation. And so we're connected there. Of course, we're connected with the judiciary. We're very nimble. We were very responsive to the court's needs, and we look at current trends that are going on, and we're very nimble in that. We're connected with our communities. Our communities are very important to us, and I would say this is probably across the board within the three delivery systems, working with our civic organizations, our juvenile organizations, and so on. We are connected with you. We are connected with the Minnesota State Legislature. You know, you provide appropriations for funding that comes down to counties level. So we include you when it comes to financing the things that we do. I talked about this earlier, about our relationship with the Department of Corrections when it comes to supervision. And they're also the pass-through dollars when it comes to legislative appropriations. We also get federal grants, so we're connected with the federal government. So very robust, progressive counties are always looking on the line to find out funding that comes from a federal level that we can apply for, use, and really work on services within our delivery. Next slide, please. So I want to talk a little bit about the services. Curtis or the Deputy Commissioner referred to this, but we're really we look at evidence-based practices across the board. Really, the intent is, what do we do to reduce recidivism? You know, the number one approach, of course, is public safety. But public safety is enhanced by what we do in the business. You know, we're counties that provide pretrial services. We have a belief in the criminal justice continuum. And that starts from the time of the arrest to the actually discharge when somebody is discharged from probation. So we're always looking at the change factor. When can we access somebody where they can look at the change themselves and we can take advantage of them? Certainly pretrial has a no different dynamic than regular traditional probation, but believe it or not, when somebody's in jail and we meet with them the next day, they've made some promises to themselves about getting mental health services, getting CD services, and we take advantage of that to try to get them in the right direction. Diversion programs, both adult and juveniles, what we want to see happen is we want people to progress through the court system that need to be addressed through the court systems, and if there's a way we can put them through a diversion system, we'll do so. Deputy Commissioner talked about a risk needs assessment. It's really about the needs assessment that goes into the risk. So understanding where people have needs really has a tendency to lower their risk, so we work hand in hand in that. Case planning, cognitive programming, this all goes to the restorative justice practices that is proven to be effective with people to get the rehabilitation required. I put in their specialty courts because county probation, Department of Corrections, CCA counties, all look at specialty courts as having a unique approach to folks that are working with certain behaviors. There's DWI courts, there's drug courts, there's veteran courts, there's domestic violence courts, and it's really about taking all the players, the collaborative efforts, including the bench, to allow them to be part of the rehabilitative process. And I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about the COVID-19 factor that's been going on in our country. We know that this has increased the number of people on supervision, which has certainly tasked the folks that we're working with, and it's meaning the probation officers that are doing the day-to-day work. We know that we have a delay in the court processes. So we know that the next 3 or 4 to 6 to 12 months, there's gonna be an influx of people coming onto field supervision. We're just preparing for that. Next slide, please. And finally, I wanna talk a little bit about funding. I talked about it earlier, where the state legislature is a partner of ours. You know, reimbursements haven't been at the level for counties for 24 years. The average reimbursement is 30%. You know, in Cass County, that comes to $93,000 in a budget cycle. So what do we do about that? Well, we constantly go back to the counties and say there's been a reduction and we'd like to, well, they're going to have to either supplement the budget or we're going to have to look at reduction in staff or reduction in programming. And the importance part of that is that we really want to get into the weeds with people to figure out exactly how we can help them to assist and work on their needs, because we know if we can facilitate that, then that is the overall reduction in public safety. And finally, I just want to say, you know, as I talked about, everything circles back to partnerships that we have within the state. I'm very proud of our partnerships, and I always want to enhance them. And so we do appreciate the relationship with the our partners. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Very rich presentation of complex, well, not complex, but some difficult decisions, particularly in terms of making sure that we're properly resourcing a vital, you know, this vital service in our state, and the partnerships that it represents with our local and state and other community entities as well. The third person we'll hear from then is Catherine Johnson from Hennepin County Community Corrections. And so, Director Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members for your opportunity, for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. As Chair Mariani mentioned, I am the director for Hennepin County's Department of Community Corrections and Rehabilitation. I'm also a member of the Executive Committee for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, or MACAC. Next slide, please. The Community Corrections Act, or CCA, was passed in 1973. It was created and supported by the Department of Corrections in an effort for to ensure that prison was reserved for only the most serious offenders. The implementation documents for the CCA made it clear that Minnesota values supervision in the community, in part because legislative leaders at the time saw that incarceration was more likely to have a detrimental than beneficial impact. CCA is funded partially with a state subsidy that was given to incentivize counties to provide supervision at the local level. The intent of that act was for a 50-50 cost sharing between the state and the county. Community Corrections Act counties provide supervision to 71% of the adult and juvenile probation and supervised release cases in the state, which means that in collaboration with CPO counties, counties themselves provide 83% of community supervision services in the state of Minnesota. Currently, there are 34 counties who have chosen to provide services under the Community Corrections Act, with a 35th, Nicollet County, set to join the model on July 1st of 2021. One of the reasons that counties choose CCA is the ability to create innovative community programming that meets the specific needs of individual counties and the unique communities that reside in those counties. Next slide, please. As you can see, the felony probation population in Minnesota has increased significantly since 1996. In fact, in 2018, the felony population was 1.5 times greater than it was in 1996. This is while we were reducing the population in our institutions. Felony supervision in the community is resource intensive, and if resources are not adequate to provide effective evidence-based practices in community supervision, it can have a direct negative impact on prison population, client success, and community safety. Next slide, please. Community supervision is effective because it focuses on changing behavior so that clients can effectively exit the criminal justice system. In the last decade, community supervision practices have come a long way. Though agents do monitor court conditions, that is not the sole focus of the service that they provide. Next slide, please. What we know in corrections and what we believe as a state is that the most volatile and dangerous offenders need to be incarcerated. But probation is, in fact, the best answer to both. Is the best answer both economically and socially for keeping tabs on other levels of nonviolent criminals and those who've served their time and have been released back into the community. Minnesota's spending on prisons as a percentage of general funds is the second lowest in the nation, largely because of the effectiveness of community corrections. Next slide, please. Regardless of delivery system, whether it be the DOC, MACPO, or MACAC, our purpose is consistent. It is to use evidence-based practices proven to reduce recidivism through cognitive behavioral interventions. That means that all of our agents are helping clients change their thinking and behaviors to keep them out of the criminal justice system, which improve both outcomes for our clients as well as improving community safety. And with that, I will end the MACAC portion and turn it back over to Deputy Commissioner Shanklin and also to the committee.
Very well, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Did you have any wrap-up comments, Deputy Commissioner, before we jump to questions, or can we just do that?
No, Chair, I do not. Thank you, though.
Okay, very well. Thank you, all three. It's hard to do justice to any of that in the 20-minute period of time. There's so many issues, questions I want to engage in and have a conversation with. We're not going to get into all of those. I was, just very quick, Ms. Johnson, I was taken by the important observation that the effective work that you all do is not just focused on court conditions. And I think part of that gets at that technical violations issues that your real value, and you said it repeatedly and so did your colleagues, is really about changing thinking and behavior. And it does strike me that, one, that there's some level of intensiveness with that, depending on where the individual is. Which requires, some level of time and quality interaction. And I'm struck by, just intuitively, how incredibly difficult it must be to be able to be effective at this work of helping individuals to change their thinking and behavior if your caseloads are huge. And so I do worry about that. And I don't know, what the metrics are, relative to those caseloads. But on a related question, because this all stitches together with resources and we're hearing about, the state falling, quite frankly, short on its target and goal of, the 50-50 with our local, with MACPO and MACAC entities. And I know that, for instance, in Ramsey County here, that, my county, has done the right thing in terms of lowering the population of individuals under supervision and done that in a safe way. But as they're effective in doing that, the formula mechanisms probably reward them by not rewarding them. In other words, you do a really good job and then we'll give you less money, And then when I think about earlier, when I said about, the existing caseloads to begin with, and the need to have that quality time, it seems to me there's a perverse incentive, that we've got built into our system. And so I'm just wondering very quickly, because there's a number of questions, if any one of you, wish to comment on that. And we'll come back to it when we have our budget discussions.
Chair Mariani, I can take that one.
Very well, Deputy Commissioner.
No, and just a good question. And to the latter part of that, I would say that I have heard it characterized as such, as somewhat of a perverse incentive. And I think you highlight, something that all of us are working to address when you talk about a jurisdiction like Ramsey County that has been on the cutting edge for sure for the work going on here in Minnesota. When we talk about how do we administer effective community supervision while also striving toward equitable outcomes. And so one of the things I think is the challenges for us is, when we think about in ways in which we can improve the work that we do, I think the formula has to be a part of that because we should, in fact, be looking for ways in which we could continue to further invest into our jurisdictions who are doing great work. And part of that might be looking at how do we incentivize those type of great both services that they're providing, supportive services, and the programming that they administer so we can continue to build on that. What we shouldn't have happen is that someone is penalized for going out there and just doing great work. when they might have colleagues that might be to some degree remaining fairly status quo. So I think when you think about looking to achieve transformative change and the outcomes at which we seek, it seems, at least from our perspective, that it's most appropriate to find further ways that we can invest in to what we know is working and what is giving us the outcomes that we are all looking to achieve. And I think Ramsey County is an example of that, but also highlights one of the hurdles that we really need to tackle.
Let's see if we can work on that this year. It's an important conversation. I'm going to move quickly, turn this in under the wire here. Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And thanks, everybody, here for the reports that you've given. The information has been very good. This goes back to looking at the fact that we have one of the lowest incarceration, just in raw numbers, lower incarceration rates, but we have one of the highest in terms of the supervised release. And my question is, and we see these disparities demographically and then also geographically. And my question is, all of these cases, they begin, well, obviously begin with law enforcement interactions, are given to prosecutors, and then prosecutors have the discretion to charge these cases and also the discretion when they're reaching any type of plea agreements to ask for a certain type of what the probationary periods or sentencing may look like. And my question is, have you all taken a look at what the impact of prosecutorial discretion is in terms of the outcomes with the high number and disparities that we have in supervised release? And that's one question. And secondly, when I look at the fact that we have these probationary periods for misdemeanors, oftentimes misdemeanors are, in many cases, nonviolent, very low risk. Would it make sense for us instead to have these folks sent into programs, programs that the data shows have had positive outcomes as opposed to bringing them into the probationary system, supervised system, and continuing to pile onto the already overburdening caseloads of our probationary officers?
Mr. Chair, hopefully you can hear me now.
Yes, we can. Welcome back, Commissioner.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you for that that question, Representative. In terms of looking at disparities, one of the things that that I can say that this group and all of the DOC and our partners have been really having some conversations about the need for us to really look at a justice reinvestment model. And one of the first parts of justice reinvestment is really an assessment of this, of system costs and all of the places where decisions get made and how that best happens and how we resource this the system. Certainly, everyone along this continuum has an obligation to ensure some level of public safety. But I think to your point, we see these disparities I want to be really clear that certainly in corrections, from a practice standpoint, we're very mindful of the fact that some of our practices perhaps result in those disparities. And we need to challenge that. And that's one of the reasons why our vision focuses on that equity piece. And I know that in the conversations with the CCA and CPO counties, it's the same thing. When we look at things geographic as well as racial disparities, which are profound in our system, we can see that as for instance, in Indian country, people end up when there is a violation, they oftentimes end up going back to prison at higher rates proportionally than the people that may be in the metro. And part of that is access to those community resources. So I think it speaks to the fact that as a state, we have to be really mindful and intentional about making sure that gets addressed. And so one of the things that I think has to happen in our state is that there does have to be a comprehensive look at how we're making decisions in the criminal justice continuum. And certainly as a member of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, that's one of the things that I know we're looking to take up and really dig into going forward. And secondarily, with your comment about the investments that we're making in lower level offense, I think this is one of the areas of focus for us. It's one of the things that we really need to look at. Who does represent the greatest risk and make sure that we're resourcing the need from a public safety standpoint? And frankly, in some instances, we would be far better off by looking at programs or using community-based partners to better support supervision of some of these lower-level people. And that is happening in many cases across our state. So We were in a wholesale agreement, and we want to make sure that that we're using our resources in the most effective way possible. And I think the questions you raised speak to that, as well as fair and equitable way possible. And these are things that we're invested in trying to look at. But one of the things we're going to need is a deep dive in terms of the data across the state.
Thank you, Commissioner. I look forward to that deep dive. And I am struck by this notion that it really is one big system. And so every point of the decision making needs to be engaged in and reviewed. I'm going to keep pressing here, Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Deputy Shanklin, just want to thank you. Had a great meeting on Wednesday with you and discussed many of those juvenile justice issues that I think we can work on in a bipartisan manner and do the best for those juveniles that we can. Just have one quick question. You mentioned that we have a very low incarceration rate, but we have a higher community release rate. Is an offender that is in prison, is he required to take community release, or does that offender have the choice to stay in custody and complete their sentence without the long, drawn-out community release? Thank you.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner.
Representative, Chair, Representative Novotny, first and foremost, I concur. A really great meeting, and just again, I appreciate your time and your thoughtfulness during that meeting. You know, to your question, I think this is also one of those things that has also been taken up by the courts. So we do have someone, you know, in our facilities, and after they complete, you know, 2/3 of their sentence, they will be released out onto supervised release. You know, there is under some would have to be extreme different scenarios and cases where someone is held within the facility at any time longer than that. It's based on certain circumstances, but more often than not, and I think that speaks to why we are looking, and again, to front load our services so that we don't run into continue to have issues on the backside of that, where we do have people who are sitting for long periods of time without receiving specific treatment directives that they might have. And so I think no one would really want to encourage anyone to have to remain in a facility, let alone having to stay in a facility through no fault of their own because programming might not be available for them during that point of time that runs up on the time when they should be on supervised release. And I think that speaks to the commissioner's goal, as well as us here at the department, on how can we continue to provide front loading of services so that those type of instances never come up, because that would be an unfortunate thing of someone feeling like they have to remain in a state facility to complete their treatment. Good question.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, and thank you for the question, Representative Nadi. It does, members, feels like there's perhaps a growing consensus here on the committee on this particular question and issues related to it. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speakers, I was curious about the fees that are often charged for correctional supervision. I know that those can be a huge burden on people who are in custody, and I had a few questions relating to that. Specifically, I was curious if you know the amount of money that was collected in the last year. I was also curious if you've collected any data around how this fee might impact recidivism. And lastly, I just practically speaking was kind of curious how it works. So if somebody is in custody, they just get like a bill every month, like they're in a hotel. I was looking at a list of those types of fees that they can incur, and a lot of them are like, we made copies. And I was just curious if some poor person is in custody, do they also then get charged every month for correctional supervision? So thank you so much.
Great question on fees. Deputy Commissioner? Or Commissioner, I'm not sure who's.
Well, I also wanted to, Chair, I think I was looking to maybe give time to some of our colleagues who yes, also presented. Yeah. So if maybe Ms. CJ Johnson, or Mr. Schneider would like, if not, I can address it.
Sure, I can, Chair Mariani, Representative, I can talk a little bit about, you know, local correctional fees. As we all know, the state legislature a number of years ago allowed probation departments to collect fees to kind of offset budgets. So in county probation departments, an example would be if you got put on supervised probation for a 2-year period, you'd be charged a $240 probation fee. And that became part of our budget because that was the expectation coming in probably would be to use those dollars to help offset your budget. So it goes directly into our budget. Now, when it comes to people not being able to pay, absolutely, we don't make them pay. You know, the idea is that there is some other accountability. Some folks do some community service work with us. You know, it's all about that planning process and, you know, everything's about case by case. So we're very aware of that, and we do not want that to hinder anything that they're trying to do with their family, with their mental health or chemical dependency needs. But we also believe we found over the years that it's also part of the accountability that they do appreciate. And so we're just mindful of that.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Members, we are at the bewitching hour. However, we do have one final member, so I'm going to extend this out just a couple of minutes here, and then I'll wrap us up. Our minority lead, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I want to thank both the Department of Corrections and the people from Probations and Community Corrections for being here today. One thing that was brought up was that we're low in down. Unfortunately, we've moved from number three and two to number five on incarceration rate, but of course that was back in 2016 stats. I think we're even better than that now. But we are up in the higher end of supervision. But one thing you have to remember, supervised supervision is a lot longer than the actual time you spend. You would have if you executed your sentence and spent the time in the facility. And we have a lot of people that can do 2, 3, sometimes 4 felony offenses before they even get incarcerated into our state system. They've spent all the 4 of those felony crimes actually on supervised supervision or doing some local time. So if we are going to do the supervised release or supervision, we are going to be in the upper third of those that are on paper or in the system just because it's so much longer time than the actual time spent in prison. The other thing I'm concerned about, and I'm hoping Commissioner Snell can give us some answers on that funding issue. Because I look at Wright County, they were $450,000 shorted from the state what we are required by our statute to provide. We have many counties. My own county was $175,000 short. That's put on the back of the taxpayers because the county is doing the state's responsibility. So we need to get that figured out and get that fixed to make sure that we are not putting the burden on the local taxpayers to take care of issues that the state is supposed to be doing. I hope Commissioner Snell can answer how he plans to take care of that. On average, we are at 30% reimbursement since 1996. And we are currently, for 2019, we're under 30% reimbursement rate.
Thank you for the question, Representative Johnson. We do have a challenge on that particular issue. Members, I'm getting messages from our IT that we literally have to get off here in the next few seconds. We're gonna do apparently some kind of IT, you know, fix kind of thing to the system. Commissioner Snell, you heard the question. We will have this conversation again. Please note it. Representative Johnson, you can hold me to making sure that your question gets addressed at a future meeting. With that, members, we are scheduled again for next Tuesday. It's going to be a busy day on Tuesday because we have Monday off for Dr. King's commemoration day. On that day, we will be covering on Tuesday COVID-19 questions with our DOC, as well as having a conversation with the legislative auditors on the safety report. Later in the week, we'll be interacting with the Pulse Board around reform efforts, and we'll hear from the Department of Human Rights relative to their emerging recommendations. They're not ready yet, but with the Minneapolis Police Department. So members, thank you for the very healthy and good conversation. Please, everyone, please be safe. Hopefully you'll be able to take some good reflection time on Monday as we recognize the work of our great American, Dr. Martin Luther King. With that, members, this committee stands adjourned.